Dr. Peter Scardino is chief of surgery at one of the most prominent cancer centers in the world, and like all departments at Memorial Sloan Kettering, urology has taken on a national leadership role not only in defining clinical standards, but in both laboratory and clinical research. I met with Dr. Scardino to find out more about where we are and where we're headed in prostate cancer clinical research, and he began our conversation by commenting on a fascinating new research project at Memorial.
We've been interested for a long time in better ways to predict outcomes in patients with prostate cancer. And as you know, one of our biggest interests is the development of these nomograms or prognostic models that I did with Mike Catan beginning 10 years ago. It's hard to believe it's been that long. And nomograms have become fairly prolific, but I think their value is to help the physicians and help patients make the best decisions in their particular situation. So nomograms are pretty mature in terms of using standard clinical data, clinical stage, Gleason grade, PSA levels. I think what we're going to see is the next generation of nomograms beginning to incorporate molecular data, and we're all very interested in what sort of molecular features might be prognostic. One of the most exciting areas in the field, still yet to sort out what its prognostic significance is this fusion gene, the TMPRSS-ERG gene that Anul Chinayan from University of Michigan discovered a couple of years ago. What he found was that in most prostate cancers in this country, you can find a fusion between two genes. One is an androgen-driven promoter called TMPRSS2, and the other is a growth factor called an ETS growth factor, the most common one of which is ERG, E-R-G. So the ERG gene fuses with the TMPRSS promoter. TMPRSS is driven by androgens, and it turns out that somewhere upwards of half of prostate cancers have this fusion gene, and it looks like what happens is the fusion gene enables the growth factor, a growth-stimulating gene, to become directly responsive to androgen levels, and it may be a major mechanism by which prostate cancers grow. So we've all been looking around the world. A number of groups have been looking at prostate cancers to see whether or not the presence of this fusion gene indicates a worse prognosis, or is it simply a step along the pathway? And right now, several studies suggest that you do have a worse prognosis. You're more likely to die of prostate cancer if you've got this fusion gene.
How much more likely?
Oh, you know, two or three times more likely. But it's not clear yet, Neil. There's a lot of work that needs to be done because there are other studies that seem to be conflicting. Now some studies are coming out saying patients with this fusion, with a single copy of the fusion, actually do better, and it's the one with multiple copies of the fusion that do worse. So we've got some work to do to sort it out, but I think it's a very exciting development because we've never found anything that's such a common chromosomal aberration in prostate cancer.
What fraction of men have it?
In the States, around 50 to 60%. In European studies, it looks like it might be a little bit lower, maybe around 35 to 45%.
Is it something that shouldn't be there, or it's just there are extra copies?
No. It should not be there. It's really a complete chromosomal change, a break with a link up of two ends of the
chromosome. Interesting. So it's broken and then they sort of stick together.
They stick together. And so you get a promoter that drives the gene, turns it on, and then you get a gene that produces a protein that we know is a growth factor important in the development of cancers.
So in terms of this kind of pathway, if you want to call it that, are there therapeutic implications?
Well, I think it certainly makes anti-androgen therapy a very logical step, and it explains one reason why androgens may be such an important part of prostate cancer. This goes along with some findings that our group published along with a very interesting biotech company called Orion.
Yeah, I was wondering what was going on there with all these papers you guys are putting out.
So we've been looking, again, we have a large number of prostate cancer patients that we've done tissue microarrays on. We've got long-term follow-up. We know what happened to them. So we're going through a whole series of molecular studies. But this particular fascinating work that Orion's doing, this is with Carlos Cordoncardo, and he developed the idea that you could take prostate cancers and develop a way to do a microscopic grade of the tumor using image analysis and computerized image analysis, sort of satellite imagery software. and you look at a cancer and you break it down into all its constituent parts, and you combine that with an immunofluorescence technique to quantify the level of certain molecular features, one of which is the androgen receptor.
So could you break that down for somebody who hasn't been to med school in the last 5 years?
Okay.
And is this part of the so-called, quote, systems pathology?
Yes.
Okay, because I like that name, but I have no idea what it means.
Okay, so systems pathology is essentially an attempt to take the subjective judgment that a pathologist uses when he sits down and looks at a cancer and he says, that looks like a cancer, and you say, why? And he can describe it somewhat, but basically it's pattern recognition. And it's subjective, it's a human ability, but it's never really been quantified. What are the different components?
Or
automated. So this is an effort to really break it down into components that would allow you to automate it using computer image analysis.
So these are like data that comes out of a machine?
Yeah. A simple way to think of it is we know, for example, that the degree of angiogenesis in a tumor is important. So a pathologist could look at a histologic section and say there are a lot of blood vessels, but you could stain the blood vessels, let's say for CD44 or something, and then you could actually get the computer to measure specifically the number of blood vessels per high-power field or per square millimeter in the tumor and quantify that exactly and get a number, a count, and then show that that count is associated, let's say, with a greater likelihood of recurrence of your cancer.
Is this something that there's a gigantic industry with 100 companies trying to do it, or is it something not too many people are doing?
It's being done in a limited way. I know of two major companies that are working in this field now. Both of them have a relationship with Yale University, and both of them are being driven by the biotech industry.
Is this, what is it, Orion, or what's the name?
Orion.
Orion, that's what they do?
This is what Orion was founded to do.
Interesting. So you're collaborating with them, they're collaborating with you to try
to... So we're collaborating. I don't have any financial relationship with them. Our interest has been, can they develop a better prognostic tool that can predict how likely a patient is to eventually die of his cancer and help us determine which ones are the favorable ones, which ones are the really high-risk tumors.
I'm trying to think of when I've heard of similar technology. And what about the technology to automate pap smears? Is that kind of the similar technology?
Similar idea. Now, there you're really looking at individual cells, so it's a little bit simpler.
Right.
Here in cancer, you're looking at tissue architecture, and you've got many different cell types there. So breaking down the patterns is a little more complicated, but with modern imaging and software, it's possible.
So what has this collaboration come up with so far?
Well, they've come up with a prognostic profile that looks like it's as good as, maybe better than, our best nomogram. We have yet to see. I think one of the most interesting biological implications of this is that one of the factors that seems to be an important prognostic factor is the level of androgen receptor in the nuclei.
Yeah, where did that come
of the
from?
Cancer cells. As
they measure that? I mean, that was like, I saw that in that paper. That was just something they happen to know how to measure, or what?
Well, obviously, we're all interested in the androgen axis in prostate cancer. And
do they stain it, or?
You stain it with an antibody, and you look at it with immunofluorescence. And with immunofluorescence compared to standard immunohistochemistry, you can quantitate the amount of fluorescence.
Interesting.
The amount of the antigen.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like, you know, you see all this stuff going on in breast cancer, you know, RT-PCR, Oncotype DX, you know, quantitation coming out. And like even ER itself has already been through a couple of iterations in breast cancer. I don't think I see that much in terms of androgen receptor.
You know, it was probably 20 years ago that we began to look at androgen receptor in prostate cancer. And at the end of the day, we found out that androgen receptor was always present in prostate cancers, and it wasn't like breast cancer. There weren't androgen receptor positive tumors and androgen receptor negative tumors that were unusually aggressive. They were virtually all androgen receptor positive.
Is prostate cancer more homogeneous genetically than, say, breast cancer?
I don't think so. I think it's just more subtle, and they're not as many. We haven't identified the key factors. This TMPRSS fusion gene that I mentioned may prove to be one of those factors.
Now, how does that gene relate to androgen receptor?
The only relationship we know of is that this TMPRSS is a gene that is androgen responsive. In other words, it's turned on when you give androgens. They bind to the androgen receptor, and it turns on downstream genes that work the effects of androgen. TMPRSS is one of those genes.
Incidentally, you know, I was kind of surprised, too, that particularly bicalutamide, but anti-androgen in general, didn't sort of take off more in prostate cancer. Because, again, it kind of reminded me of tamoxifen in breast cancer, but it just sort of never went anywhere. And I never really was sure whether it was just wasn't working or was it wasn't studied.
No, it was studied thoroughly, and it's working. It just turns out, I think you're about to see, in the next 5 years, Chapter 2 of the anti-androgen story.
Good.
Right. So Chapter 1 was, we knew that if you did castration and you got rid of androgens, almost all of these prostate cancers would respond for a while. We knew that they virtually all had androgen receptor, but we couldn't quantitate it. So now I think there are several really interesting pieces of the androgen story that are beginning to come out. So one is, it looks like aggressive cancers from early in their stage have high levels of androgen receptor in the nucleus.
So high Gleason already. Scores?
Higher Gleason scores, poor
have more androgen receptor.
Have more androgen receptors.
It's so, kind of counterintuitive.
So it's surprising, but it turns out that the higher your androgen receptor level in your tumor, the more likely your cancer is to recur afterwards.
Oh, and you guys showed that. Right. Had that been seen before?
No, that had not been seen before. Now, the second interesting part of the story is that it turns out when you really study the anti-androgens that have been available, Casodex, flutamide, nilutamide, they're relatively weak anti-androgens compared to other agents that act on a specific targeted pathway. It takes a heck of a lot of these drugs to have an impact on their target, like the androgen receptor. And so various people, Charles Sawyers particularly, has gone to the lab and said, let's discover a more powerful anti-androgen.
And these are competitive inhibitors, right? So you need it.
Exactly. These are competitive inhibitors, but the drug he developed was much more likely. The trouble with the anti-androgens we have, Casodex, flutamide, is that you give them for a while, you respond, and then they switch over from being an antagonist to an agonist. They start stimulating.
Right.
That's why
withdrawal
we get
response,
the
yeah.
withdrawal response.
Yeah. So what's the drug
Sawyers has a new drug that they designed specifically that works as a much more powerful antagonist, but will not switch on as an agonist.
Interesting.
And they identified the molecular trigger, how it turns on and how it becomes an agonist.
What's it called, and has it been looked at in humans?
You know, it doesn't have a name
like
yet.
Letters and numbers?
Yeah, it's got letters and numbers right now. It's just in the earliest clinical trials. Howard Scher's group, along with MD Anderson, Dana-Farber, a group of 11 centers around the country, is looking at it. And it's too early to say, but
clinically,
I can tell
they're
you,
looking at it?
It's in a phase one clinical trial,
oral?
A dose escalation clinical trial, and it's looking very interesting.
Oral?
It's oral. It's an oral agent just like Casodex.
So they have a preparation. It's being tested.
Yes. Now, based upon the principle that, again, another chapter in this new androgen story. So Charles Sawyers did a brilliant study about 3 years ago published in Nature where they said they looked at a bunch of prostate cancers in tissue culture and they said, what does it take to make these cells hormone refractory? And it turns out, after a series of really elegant experiments, that all it takes is for the androgen receptor to go up about 3 times higher than it is in a normal cell.
Really?
Yes.
Why?
Well, it turns out that androgen receptor is such a powerful growth stimulus in the presence of androgen that all it has to do is upregulate a little bit, and it sucks up all the ligand, all the androgen it can get. Now, in addition to that, it turns out that probably some prostate cancers, particularly metastatic cancers, may have the capacity to produce their own androgens. So they become autocrine producers of
through
androgen.
Through aromatase?
Through aromatase. It turns
have
out...
Have AIs been looked at in prostate?
Very limited way.
Think it would work?
I don't know. I think that's...
Wow, that's interesting.
Now, it turns out, you know, even after castration, even after LHRH, your adrenal glands and your peripheral tissues still make some androgens. But the cancer, turns out, can make some androgens. So there's a new drug called abiraterone. I don't know if you've heard about
it.
So
I'm guessing it's an AI except for androgens.
So
it pretends.
Exactly. What it does is it absolutely blocks the androgen synthesis pathway throughout the whole body. This has been used. The initial clinical trials were done in England. Spectacular responses in men with hormone refractory prostate cancer. It's now in clinical trials in the U.S. looking good. It's an oral agent.
How about side effects and toxicity?
Minimal side effects.
I mean,
so
it sounds
far.
Kind of bad to think about the androgen receptor being blocked everywhere. Of course, tamoxifen does it for breast.
Sure. I mean, you get a profound androgen deprivation when you use LHRH or Casodex.
Right.
So from all this data, I think we're about to see a whole-scale attack on the androgen receptor in advanced hormone-refractory prostate cancer, where we thought blocking androgens was worthless. Now we're going to be able to stop androgen synthesis everywhere in the body. We're going to be able to have a super Casodex-type drugs, and we're going to have drugs which actually knock down the androgen receptor itself. So we'll have sort of a three-pronged attack on so-called hormone-refractory prostate cancer that turns out not to be so hormone-refractory after all.
I wonder whether, you know, maybe there's more potential in hormonal therapy in prostate cancer than we realize.
I think that's exactly right. After years of desperately searching for the chemotherapeutic drugs that the breast cancer people have had, it turns out that the hormone approach is probably where there's a lot more money.
Well, you know, sure, hormone therapy has been a great advance in breast cancer, but tons of women with ER-positive breast cancer die,
right,
and in spite of getting hormone therapy. But, you know, maybe prostate cancer is going to be different. Maybe if we get better tools, understand what's going on, maybe it's more hormone sensitive. But you're saying that more androgen receptor means they do worse.
That's correct.
Suppose you give them androgen deprivation, though.
Well,
you know, it's like the HER2 thing in breast cancer. They have a worse prognosis. You give them trastuzumab, they actually do better.
So we don't really have this sorted out yet because we haven't quantitated androgen receptor enough farther along the disease. In a preliminary way, this is very preliminary, the men who had high levels of androgen receptor in their primary prostate tumors that we removed surgically, I already said they tend to have a worse prognosis. Then if you follow them along and some of them recur, their PSA starts rising, and you treat them with hormones then, they respond for a shorter period of time to hormones than men whose PSA relapses. With a low androgen receptor, they respond a longer period of time. So I think what may be happening is, for some reason, these tumors innately have the ability to upregulate their androgen receptor. And even when you treat them with anti-androgens, they overcome it quicker because their receptor level is high and they can soak up androgens from the body.
So if you did a randomized study specifically looking at men with elevated androgen receptors to immediate androgen deprivation, I mean before they have PSA progression, right then and there versus nothing, what do you think you'd see?
Well, I think you're always going to see a delayed progression if you use the hormone therapy. The question is, in the long run, are they going to actually live longer or actually shorter? I'd be worried. What I would want to do, there's a new trial now starting for men with a rapidly rising PSA after surgery, randomizing the patients to 2 years of hormones versus 2 years of hormones plus Taxotere.
Yeah.
So nice study. The goal of that is, will we get a longer period of undetectable PSAs if we add chemotherapy to the hormones?
Hopefully now, longer survival. Less
now, what about if you did that trial in those men with elevated androgen receptor?
Right,
it seems
right.
to me that those people are at greatest risk of not having a long period of graceful survival with hormones alone and may be the ones that most need chemotherapy.
Maybe that company and you ought to go and try to find the tumor blocks from the EPC studies.
And take a look at the androgen receptor
yeah.
level. So I think those are the kind of things that will be done as we validate this and get more data to really support it. I think right now this is very new research findings. It's not really been thoroughly validated in a large group, but I think that's exactly the next step.
Interesting. So you mentioned the issue of chemotherapy. Where are we right now? And what's your take as a urologist of what's going on the last few years in terms of docetaxel?
Well, I think that everybody was pleased to see that there was objective evidence of prolonged survival in men with hormone-refractory advanced prostate cancer with a chemotherapeutic drug, because we had never been able to find a drug that really did prolong survival. And I think we're all very interested in, would it help men if we bring the drug earlier in the disease? There's been a lot of debate about what the right trial is to demonstrate that and when you should use it. There's been a few small institutional or small group studies looking at neoadjuvant Taxotere, and there's a big CALGB or intergroup study that's going to look at very high-risk localized disease treated with either radiation or surgery and getting neoadjuvant hormones versus hormones plus chemotherapy. you know, I'm hopeful that those things will show a response, and I think they probably will. There may be some improvement, but I think we badly need something more powerful. A single drug, there are very few diseases where a single chemotherapeutic drug has really been able to make a big dent in long-term survival.
I guess one of the things that I've seen in the last couple of years that really surprised me is the patient who has PSA-only disease but is clearly hormone refractory. Would you consider chemotherapy docetaxel off study? When I was asking that question 2 years ago, I was getting absolutely not. And now I'm starting to get high rapid PSA doubling time, maybe. Is that what you're hearing with your oncologist?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, look, prostate cancer has become largely a PSA disease. And we did some studies a couple of years ago looking at men initially treated with surgery. They failed with rising PSA. They got hormones. They responded to hormones for a long period of time, more than 10 years on average. And then when they relapsed with a rising PSA, our data showed they had almost equally a poor prognosis, whether at the time of that hormone refractory relapse, it was just PSA or it was PSA plus metastasis, that they tended to have a rapid doubling time in the whole group, and they really had a worse prognosis. There's a subset of men who relapse in a hormone refractory way who have a slow PSA doubling time, and they seem to have a longer survival. But for a rapid doubling time, I don't think we have satisfactory treatment for them. And sure, I think we would seriously consider chemotherapy. We're looking at various immune strategies. I mean, that's another interesting area in this whole prostate cancer picture is immune manipulation.
I'm curious from your perspective as a urologist what you think about chemotherapy in terms of this sort of new era of chemotherapy for prostate cancer. What do you think about quality of life and the treatments, particularly the docetaxel treatments, the patients that you see, if you see them after they're being treated? And breast cancer and the other tumors, we kind of get used to that's part of adjuvant therapy. And what do you think about docetaxel and the newer regimes are using prostate?
It's amazing, isn't it, Neil, how different the culture is in breast and prostate cancer. I mean, every woman practically who has a primary breast tumor gets 6 months of adjuvant chemotherapy, and no men do. And that can't be right. There are probably too many women getting treated and too few men. The difference, obviously, is the randomized trials that show prolonged survival, albeit small, but it was measurable and it was statistically significant, and it was a real benefit to the chemotherapy. And women, the culture has developed that this is the traditional treatment. Will we get there in men? I think it would take evidence of very significant benefit in these earlier trials to really begin to change that.
I will tell you one thing you might find interesting, because people have brought up the question of men versus women and their attitudes in general towards chemotherapy. And we actually reported a study at ASCO and at ASCO GI in colon cancer, where we asked a lot of these trade-off questions. These are people who'd had chemo. How much benefit would you need? You know, because the perception, as you say, breast cancer, women are going to take therapy even for very modest improvements. And the interesting thing was not only do we see that the colon cancer patients seem roughly indirectly comparison to be as motivated to take chemo if they thought they could get a little bit of benefit, but we saw no difference in men versus women.
Right.
Does that surprise you?
I don't think it's the men versus women. I think it's the disease is a little different and the perception of benefit is a little different. So one of the big differences in prostate is we have PSA. So if you've got a very bad prostate cancer and I operate on you, I may say you've got a 50-50 chance of recurrence, you should go on an adjuvant chemotherapy. But you may say, well, isn't my PSA going to go up if I recur? And won't it go up 6 or 8 years before I have metastatic disease? So if I don't recur and my PSA stays zero, why should I take it? If I do recur, I've got 6 to 8 years lead time to take the therapy.
Oh, yeah, I'm not suggesting that it needs to be adjuvant chemo.
Right.
It might be chemo at PSA relapse.
I think that's
but
a
I
much
mean,
more likely scenario.
You're still dealing with an asymptomatic person who's trying to improve their prognosis.
I don't think there's any reluctance to do that if we had some evidence of benefit. And Ben, I think that's exactly why the trial that was designed to look at taxotere in an early stage was for PSA relapse with the right kinetics that suggested more aggressive disease, and then use standard treatment hormones versus hormones plus chemotherapy.
Although there is what I would call a more pure adjuvant trial where you get started right at surgery.
Right.
And you know, to me, if you've got good predictors and you know the patients are, yes, maybe you can get away with waiting, but I think it's a reasonable clinical trial question to look at that at least.
It would be.
I've got to say that kind of being an outsider, it was kind of discouraging looking at prostate in terms of the amount of clinical trial findings available, at least today. I mean, maybe that's going to change. I'm not really sure about that, but it's kind of discouraging to see so much data, and even lung now has tons of data.
I think you're right. For example, you know, there's really never been a large-scale phase 3 study of local therapy for prostate cancer. I mean, the only really great trial was the Swedish randomized trial of watchful waiting versus surgery. The pivot trial in this country, the same watchful waiting versus surgery, has not yet been reported. It's been going on for over 10 years. In fact, I'm going to the Medical Advisory Board meeting in January to get an update on that trial. It's finished accruing. It's monitoring. There have been lots of radiotherapy trials, RTOG, but they all tend to be radiotherapy plus something versus radiotherapy plus nothing, but everybody gets radiotherapy. This DOD-sponsored clinical trials consortium that all the major prostate cancer investigators are in, Phil Kantoff from Dana-Farber, Eric Small from UCSF, Chris Logothetis from MD Anderson, Mario Eisenberger from Hopkins, Howard Scherr is the coordinating center here. These guys have 11 centers. They're very dedicated prostate cancer investigators. They very, very carefully defined what are the response criteria that we're looking for that would allow us to take drugs through. And they're accruing at the level of 70 to 100 patients a month. This is really an investigator-driven group. I mean, the Prostate Cancer Foundation has had a big role in this. Hmm. It's currently funded by a Department of Defense, but they work closely with the FDA in terms of what are the criteria that will lead to the approval of a drug. But it's very scientifically oriented. It's not
translational stuff, too?
Some translational stuff, but they don't let the translational questions stop the therapeutic questions. I mean,
sure,
the
yeah.
goal is let's find things
treatments.
That work.
Right.
But if we can, let's do as much science along the way as possible.
You know, most, if not all, the people that you mentioned are medical oncologists. And that's the other question I kind of wonder about in prostate, which is, should the medical oncologists be more integrated? I see oncs in practice going, well, I don't see prostate that much. They don't seem as confident dealing with it as they do with all these other diseases. And the one thing about med-oncs is they know to get trials done. And I wonder whether they could help move things forward by being more integrated in the community.
You're right in the community level, because it's been traditional in the community level for the urologist to give the patient hormones. And hormones work for a long time. And then there's a short period, you know, typical survival is about a year when you get hormone refractory
right.
metastatic disease. So there's not much for the medical oncologist to work with. I think what's happening at the medical center level or in the research circles is the medical oncologists are very involved. So if you look at the SPORs, there's 11 SPORs in prostate cancer, these specialized programs of research excellence. This Department of Defense Clinical Trials Consortium is all medical oncologists. There's much at the idea generation stage, there's more. And I think as we get agents that actually work earlier in the disease, I think it'll move out into the medical oncologist community. There's been a kind of a silly turf battle going on where there was a movement, I would say, is probably the most formal name you could give to it, a period when a number of medical oncologists got together to push the agenda that we should be the ones that manage all prostate cancer after the initial surgery or radiotherapy
when
is done.
When was that?
That was several years ago at ASCO. There was a draft declaration
really?
That every patient should see a medical oncologist.
I didn't know that.
And that created a lot of anxiety and turf battle, and that's dropped off. I think the truth is we're going to serve the patients better if we work together.
The thing is, you guys have a platform that almost nobody else has, which is PSA-only disease.
Right.
I mean, that's what Howard and, you know, his group is really, and it seems like that's where maybe some of these new agents, you really have the opportunity to
sure.
really test it out.
Look, I think if this trial we talked about earlier, which is looking at Taxotere, for example, chemotherapy for PSA relapse with a short doubling time. If that trial were positive, it would establish a new standard of care where men at PSA relapse would need to be evaluated by a medical oncologist. And
right.
medical oncologists would become much more sophisticated about interpreting PSA kinetics, and it would shift the disease years earlier into the medical oncologist office.
Well, one of the things that's interesting we've seen with medical oncologists when we do surveys, which we do all the time, is they do a lot of clinical trial stuff. I mean, they have research nurses in their office. I mean, not that urologists or rad-oncs don't, but maybe 3/4 of oncologists in this country are participating in clinical trials. So they have the infrastructure to get the thing done, but they're going to need to see the patient at probably PSA-only disease for a lot of these studies.
For the studies, there's no question, but I think that system is getting in place. I think this clinical trials consortium, I think, will grow steadily and spill out. They're not going to be able to do phase 3 trials in this small group. This is 11 research intensive centers that are at the level of getting drugs through phase 2 to really show that they are promising. But when they come to phase 3, they're going to have to go to the standard clinical trials group or have a big industry-sponsored study. And you'll need the medical oncologist in the communities and widespread medical centers to put patients on clinical trials at that magnitude for phase 3 studies.
I mean, you got tons of men in that situation, and I think they would be very receptive to research looking at new strategies rather than just some more hormone therapy.
I think so, too. But don't forget, hormone therapy ain't what it used to be. And it may be that the newer agents and the newer approaches may essentially be a form of biological therapy as powerful as imatinib and the other.
Absolutely.
We've run our course. We've done as much as we can with the LHRH agonist and with the available anti-androgens. I mean, all that debate for years about whether the combination was better than the single agent didn't get us very far down the road, and we need to move on to much more effective levels of treatment. I would want to look at a strategy that promised me some chance of cure while I had minimal disease.
Yep.
And I don't know that I would go on hormones too early, because I don't think there's much evidence that starting them real early when your PSA is moving slowly is going to make a difference in your survival.
Yeah, no, you're right. I guess at that point, really the key option is doing nothing. And again, I'd say if somebody says to me, you want to do nothing and watch your PSA, you want to take a shot at something new, I like taking a shot at something new.
I totally agree. And I think we're going to see new options coming out rapidly in the next 5 years. There's a lot of good, exciting things on the drawing board, including, we talked about combinations of hormone plus the immunotherapy agents. I might just throw in another really fascinating study that Jim Allison's group just did, is that they looked at a molecule called B7 in the prostate. So B7 is another one of these immune suppressive molecules that turns off the T cells and stops them from attacking a cancer. Turns out that prostate cancer has an unbelievable high level of B7 on the surface of prostate cells. And the higher the level, the poorer the prognosis. So it looks like these cancers have an immune-proof sort of coating that is another possible target of therapy. So we're racking up more immune strategies. And I think a combination that can really get rid of these cancers, I doubt if any of these hormone strategies are really going to cure prostate cancer. But if you combine a hormone strategy with an immune strategy with a chemotherapy strategy in the right way, now I think you could begin to think about curing metastatic prostate cancer.
It's interesting just listening to you and thinking about the fact that you're a surgeon, but kind of what I hear you talking about is not the things that we kind of think of about surgeons talking about.
Well, we've been focusing, in the world of surgery, there's some fascinating things going on. If you want to just take a minute to, I'll give you a quick overview of my take on it. Right now, everybody is kind of intoxicated with the robot.
Right.
In my opinion, the robot is not going to represent a significant step forward. I think the robot will allow surgeons who are open surgeons to do laparoscopic surgery with much less training than it would have taken them if they had to become full laparoscopic surgeons. So lots of surgeons who never went through formal laparoscopic training can get trained on the robot and do the operation. I think from all the evidence I see, the quality of the operation overall today is certainly no better than good open surgery. And in fact, because people are starting so far back on the learning curve, it's actually worse, and it's going to take a lot of time and experience and good surgeons to learn how to do it right. At the end of the day, the robot will be largely the way we do prostate cancer surgery, but we're not going to have better cancer control, better continence, or better potency than we have today. We're just going to have an operation that's a little bit easier for the patient in terms of a little less blood loss, a little shorter hospital stay, a little quicker convalescence.
So, do you do it?
I don't do the robot, but we do it at our institution.
But you think 5-10 years from now, that's what it's going to be?
I think so. It's easy to do, and
how many years from now?
I would say that 10 years from now, that will be the overwhelmingly dominant way we do prostate cancer surgery.
But 10 years from now, how about if we don't do prostate cancer surgery?
Well, when are we not going to do it? In my opinion,
or breast surgery,
somewhere around a third to a half of all men diagnosed today, maybe more, have such a small, non-threatening prostate cancer that doing radical surgery or radiation is overkill. And I think what we're going to see is a whole series of technologies that allow us to do what I like to call focal therapy. In other words, sort of a lumpectomy type thing. I think we're going to be able to go in, identify where a cancer is in the prostate, knock out that area of the prostate, and watch the patient along. And maybe 3 years later or 5 years later, you'll have a little area in another place and we can knock that out. And if the cancer ever gets more serious, then we'll do radical surgery or radiation therapy.
Couldn't we just take a pill and not do anything?
Wouldn't it be nice if we could?
Well, look, I mean, the things that you just talked about, I mean, is that out of the question?
Well, look, we've got incredible strong evidence from the prostate cancer prevention trial that a simple drug, which is now generic, like finasteride, will actually significantly lower the risk of prostate cancer. Now, there was a lot of worry, and you know, I wrote the editorial for the New England Journal pointing out what the worries were. There was a worry that we were going to cause high-grade cancer in some men. I think that worry has largely been put to rest.
There's been some more data on that, too,
There's been some very good studies that have finally been published. We knew about them a couple of years ago, but it's taken a while to get them published, that show, in fact, not only does finasteride not cause high-grade cancer, it was an artifact, a sampling artifact, because finasteride shrunk the prostate.
Right.
The men with the small prostate had just as many cores taken as the men with the bigger prostates on the placebo, and so they found the high-grade cancer in those men.
And that never made any sense to me anyhow.
Right. Finasteride does not cause high-grade cancer. In fact, if you do the numbers and correct for the smaller size of the prostate, the reduction in cancer was 25% in the original report, is probably more like 33%. And the adverse events, well, they're no worse than they are for men with BPH, a small risk of decreased libido, decreased erections, which are reversible if you stop the medication.
So you're saying you think that could be part of prostate cancer control or something else like it?
I think it could well be part of prostate cancer control. Finasteride, I think, is a good sample. I give it to my patients now who have a high PSA and a negative biopsy, men who have symptoms of BPH who are worried about cancer.
Huh.
And even dutasteride, the other 5-alpha reductase inhibitor, is being looked at in a randomized trial in men with very tiny, small cancers, Gleason 3+3, randomized to placebo plus finasteride, followed to see if finasteride or dutasteride can prevent progression in these patients. So chemo prevention, I think, is going to be a real possibility. Focal therapy for small lesions, I think robotic surgery will probably continue to develop, and obviously radiotherapy is getting increasingly better.